Hello and welcome to the local news. I'm Cynthia Elkins reporting for KMUD. In today's news, an update on Pacific Lumber's restructuring plans. We'll check in with the county election office as Super Tuesday nears, and more on the case over the lease dispute for Reggae on the River. All that and more coming right up. A Hoopa man was struck and killed by a car on Highway 96 near Willow Creek last night, according to the California Highway Patrol. Police reports indicate that Harold Nathaniel Jackson was crossing Highway 96 near Hostler Field Housing Road and was not in a crosswalk. The CHP says the driver of one vehicle saw Mr. Jackson in the road and was able to swerve and miss him. However, police say that a second car was unable to avoid Mr. Jackson and struck him at about 8 p.m. The county's coroner office reports that Mr. Jackson died at the Mad River Emergency Room as a result of blunt force trauma wounds. Conditions at the time of the collision were reportedly very rainy, and police are still investigating the cause of this fatal incident. Three different proposals to restructure Pacific Lumber Company were submitted to the bankruptcy court yesterday. The two largest creditors to Pacific Lumber Company submitted one plan each, and Pacific Lumber Company also submitted an amended plan. The company previously submitted a reorganization plan that hinges on the development of 22,000 acres of forest land into what it termed kingdom properties. In its revised plan, Pacific Lumber is still proposing development on some areas of forest land, but the development would be a mixture of luxury and affordable housing in what it calls cluster developments. One of the other plans was submitted by Marathon LLC and, as expected, would have Mendocino Redwood Company managing the forest land. KMUD News spoke with CEO of Mendocino Redwood Mendocino Redwood Company, Sandy Dean, who explained the ideas they have in mind.
The plan that got filed yesterday fills in a lot of the details of what was described in a summary way back in December. And so we've partnered with Marathon, one of the two large creditors in the Pacific Lumber Company bankruptcy, to put forth a plan that starts by saying bring Mendocino Redwood Company's forest practices to the Pacific Lumber Company lands, to immediately seek Forest Stewardship Council certification of the Pacific Lumber Company lands in a reorganized format, to work to both invest in the Scotia Sawmill and bring the management team of the Mendocino companies to the Scotia Mill to do all that we can to make that mill successful. And we would do all of these things without seeking any government or philanthropic funds to support it. In addition to that, there's some details in the plan that are new, and a couple of things that come out of that is we talk about the importance of integrating the sawmill with the land operationally, and we further talk about the experience that Mendocino has had where having the forest and the sawmill and distribution operations associated with the sawmill as being really important for the success of the forest long term. And so the Mendocino companies have one sawmill that makes about 55 million board feet of lumber a year, but through Mendocino Forest Products and an affiliate, we actually distribute almost 400 million board feet of lumber to a large and diverse group of customers. And one of the key components of the plan that got put forth is that we would share that distribution infrastructure and those customer relationships with the reorganized Pacific Lumber Company to allow the Pacific Lumber Company to realize more value from the wood products that come off of the forest.
Now, you told me earlier that you would envision that there would be a reduction in the amount of logging that's currently taking place on Pacific Lumber Company's lands as part of your plan. So if Pacific Lumber Company has only added to its debt over the years, and you would be saying, you say that you would be logging less, how would you see that this would be profitable and that you would be able to do better than Pacific Lumber Company has been able to do?
Well, we do think that the harvest rate will come down, and we also feel that, in particular, with a different approach to the sawmill and incorporating the distribution of the lumber products that come out of the sawmill based on having the Mendocino company's management team that's been together for almost 10 years carefully review what could be accomplished based on what we accomplished at Mendocino Redwood Company. We feel like that we can duplicate what has worked for Mendocino Redwood Company and do that in Humboldt County and be successful. And we have studied it very carefully and have a full set of financial projections that are built up with a very detailed analysis supporting what we're doing, and that's all based on the experience that we have, you know, one county away over many years.
In your court filings, you say that the debtors have claimed that their bankruptcy is a result of not being able to log at a level they need to service their debt because of what they characterized as a snarl of litigation. And you said that that you believe that the debtors' problems go further than that and are larger. Can you explain what you meant?
Sure. And I think the filing, I think the paragraph you're referring to was written by lawyers, and they start by saying that the debtors claim that all their problems are a function of the snarl of litigation that they've had. And the litigation surely has slowed the company down. But we think that there's the sawmill problems in particular are more than just harvest-related. It's more than just the volume of logs that come into the sawmill that's caused the problem there. And so we think a different approach to the sawmill will matter. We think that the litigation is largely a result of hostility over the company's practices, and we think that changing the company's practices and doing what we've done in Mendocino County to adopt forest policies that are more balanced towards ecological progress in the forest will make a difference. We think that working with the community in an open and transparent fashion will make a difference. So we'll look to do the same things that have worked well for Mendocino Redwood Company over time with the Pacific Lumber Company operations.
I spoke with Linda Perkins of the Sierra Club a couple of weeks ago, and she said that although she believes that the Mendocino Redwood Company has improved their practices, she did still have some concerns, and one of those concerns was related to your old growth policy. Would you be applying the same policy in Humboldt County as you currently use in Mendocino?
That's a great question, and if people want to know what our old growth policy is, it's fairly detailed. It's on our website. Our website is www.mrc.com, and we so the short answer to your question is yes, we would apply the same policy, and a little bit in addition to that, I guess, is that the policy was developed over roughly a 2-year period, 98 through 2000. We knew from the beginning at Mendocino Redwood Company that we wanted to protect the old growth that we had, but the question is, what exactly is old growth? And defining old growth is something that is a little bit of a challenge. Most people have a sense that they know it when they see it, but what does that really mean when you get down to the level of a single tree? We wanted to define old growth down to the level of individual trees because on Mendocino's land, there's maybe 100 acres of unentered old growth left, but then there's scattered residual old growth trees. We wanted to save those. So we developed what we think is a good ecologically based policy that ensures that we save any old growth tree that we come across in the forest, and that policy has worked pretty well. Yes, I am sure that there are folks who might like to see the policy tweaked in one way or another, and I think Linda probably has well thought out views on that. But we think the policy has allowed us to save the old growth that we come across in the forest.
So you said you've been looking at the possibility of having something to do with Pacific Lumber Company lands for 3 years. What initially attracted you to Pacific Lumber Company's lands and made you think about considering this?
That's a great question. We started having conversations at their initiation, and what made us engage in the conversations and continue to have the conversations over time was a sense that the things that had worked well for us at Mendocino Redwood Company had begun to show that it was possible to have a private model that could work in the Redwood region where the forest could be managed to a standard that people would accept and where the business could be a successful business. And as we began to have more visibility on that, we have had an interest to try and do more of the same, to show that this is not just a one-off in Mendocino County, but that it could work in other places too.
In addition to Pacific Lumber's plan and the plan involving Mendocino Redwood Company, the note holders involved in the bankruptcy case also submitted a plan for restructuring Pacific Lumber Company. The plan submitted by the note holders would essentially auction off the company's assets. A consortium of conservation groups and investors announced their intention to develop a plan for Pacific Lumber Company that they say would include sustainable logging and preservation of valuable wildlife habitat. Many had believed that their plan would be included in a proposal submitted to the court, but that did not prove to be the case. It now appears that the consortium would have to bid on the forest land and other assets as part of an auction if the note holder's proposal is adopted by the court. KMUD News also spoke to Sam Johnson of the Environmental Protection Information Center about the different proposed plans. EPIC is one of the unsecured creditors involved in the bankruptcy proceeding, and Mr. Johnson told KMUD News that they are carefully examining the different proposals to restructure Pacific Lumber.
EPIC, first of all, certainly appreciates all the efforts that have been undertaken by the major creditors to present reorganization plans, as well as this proposal by the Alliance of Conservation Groups that would promote a sustainable vision for the future of Humboldt. And, the reason EPIC is so appreciative of these efforts at coming up with alternative plans is because they really highlight the supreme importance of removing Maxam from control of these companies. And because it's quite clear now that, in contrast to the efforts that have been put forth by the creditors and others, that Pacific Lumber has continued pushing the company downward to benefit itself at the expense of its creditors and the local community. Secondly, EPIC recognizes that there's a risk going forward if there's no agreement that is reached among the non-Maxam parties. And, one possible outcome of this is an auction sale of the Pacific Lumber companies. And, if the ideal outcome from EPIC's point of view would be some kind of agreement that would hold the companies together under a management scenario that would promote beneficial logging both for ecosystems and for the local economy. There's no guarantee that a favorable outcome will result from an auction of these companies. On the other hand, EPIC is evaluating all these proposals, and they're kind of complicated. And so when EPIC evaluates them, we are going to keep in mind certain core principles that are going to be prerequisites. In other words, that whoever owns the land is going to have to manage it according to certain principles that have been really given short shrift by Maxam and Hurwitz. And those principles would include several things. I'll just mention a few. One would be permanent protection of remaining old-growth groves and trees, and recruitment of that kind of habitat, especially for the needs of the endangered species like marbled murrelet and coho salmon. Another important principle is the transition to uneven age logging and the elimination of clear cutting, other destructive silvicultural practices. Another and very important component would be the preservation and enhancement of workers' jobs and the local economy, the Scotia Mill, and a community stake in the company, if it's at all possible. We need protection of watersheds. We need to repair the damaged watersheds to take care of the interests of downstream landowners and other stakeholders. There needs to be company transparency on information about inventory and financial structure. And there needs to be permanent protection for what are known as the marbled murrelet conservation areas. So those at a minimum, and there are several other important principles that are going to have to be carried out. And so EPIC is going to be looking very closely at all these plans to see what is the best moving forward.
Now, Sam, how will your organization be evaluating the note holders' plan, which is basically to auction off the forest land and mill? And when holding, you don't know who might own the land as a result of that auction. So how can you evaluate whether or not the principles that you believe are important will be applied, and how are you able to evaluate that idea?
Well, that's an excellent question. and of course, we haven't had a chance to review the entire note holders' plan yet, but You know, I would say that we would look at it in terms of the likely effects it's going to have on the local community, the local economy, and the ability of whoever the owner becomes to manage it sustainably. And, you know, one thing we would certainly not want to see would be an auction in which some entity like another big industrial timber company comes along and buys it, or even perhaps worse, some kind of development interest. So, certainly hope is good, but it's not enough, and it's probably not enough to just hope that the right person, the right entity, is going to emerge successfully from an auction. But on the other hand, Epic has to go look at these at the proposal itself to see. But essentially, again, we'll be looking at our principles, and if there's an undue risk that some other entity might, like an industrial timber company, might come along, then that would be problematic. On the other hand, we recognize that it's also quite possible that an auction could bring a good outcome, and we will be, closely looking at all the plans and proposals and developments to see if such an outcome is likely. And if it is, then perhaps we'll support it. But again, we just need to make these evaluations, and we'll be making more comments about that in the coming days and weeks.
All creditors involved in the Pacific Lumber bankruptcy case will vote on the proposed plans if disclosure statements for those plans are confirmed by the court. If there's no agreement between the parties on one of the plans, the judge will choose among any that are selected by a class of creditors. Well, Super Tuesday is right around the corner, and the election is undoubtedly on many people's minds. KBUN News checked in with the county elections office to see how things are going there. And Carolyn Cernich, Carolyn Cernich said she's hoping people will make sure to know where their polling place is, and she pointed out a handy website to find it.
One thing that's very helpful for voters throughout the state of California is, and probably elsewhere too, is the League of Women Voters smartvoter.org. It's a site where you can input your street address or the address that you live at, and it will tell you where your polling place is. It doesn't ask you your name or your political affiliation or anything. It just tells you where the person living at this address would go to vote. So if you're confused about that, it's on the back of your sample ballot that you received, but it's also at smartvoter.org.
What might people who voted via absentee ballots be able to do if they voted for one of the candidates that has since dropped out of the race?
Well, if they have already submitted their ballot, either mailed it in or delivered it to the elections department, it's too late. That ballot is cast. If, however, they have marked that ballot and still have the ballot in their possession, it can be surrendered at their polling place. At their polling place, they have to go to the correct precinct, they can be issued another ballot. If they live in a mail ballot precinct, they can surrender it to the elections department. If they wish to have another ballot issued, they have to go to their own precinct or to the elections department.
And Ms. Cernich, is there any idea or guesstimation in terms of how many absentee ballots have been received by the elections office so far?
Well, here in Humboldt County, I believe we may be over 10,000 now.
And how many absentee voters are there in the county?
We have, I haven't checked lately to see how many are registered, but we have something over 25,000 as permanent absentee voters or vote-by-mail voters.
Can you start counting those absentee ballots right away, or do you have to wait until Election Day?
No, the law allows us to begin processing them. We can run them through the optical scan device, but we cannot call for a report or get a total or a tally on those absentee ballots until after the polls close on Tuesday.
With only a few days left between now and Super Tuesday, Carolyn Cernich had these words for the community.
I hope everybody knows that Tuesday is Election Day, and I hope they will check their sample ballot and or smartvoter.org and go to the correct polling place to vote.
Again, that was Carolyn Cernich, the county clerk for Humboldt County. A court-appointed referee continued to hear testimony in the case involving a lease dispute for Reggae on the River. KMUD News reported that Tom Dimmick was questioned on the stand Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, and today Susie Matilla appeared as a witness. Ms. Matilla was the bookkeeper for the Mateel Community Center from the early 1990s till 2003. Ms. Matilla also became the bookkeeper for People Production around 1994. KMUD News coordinator Terry Clementson has been attending the hearing and explained what happened at today's proceeding.
Today's reference proceeding started with Susie Matilla on the stand. Ms. Matilla was the bookkeeper for the Mateel Community Center in the past, and in the year of 1994, People Productions, the inception of People Productions occurred. At that year, 1994, Susie Matilla became the bookkeeper for People Productions. Mr. Bragg, who is the Mateel's attorney in this case, asked Ms. Matilla, why did you switch your role as bookkeeper from the Mateel to bookkeeper for People Productions? And Ms. Matilla said, quote, because of the attitude that I received from the Mateel, end quote. Ms. Matilla went on to state that separate books were kept for Reggae on the River and for People Production, which conformed to the production contract. Ms. Matilla testified that during the spring of 2005, contract negotiations between Hannah Nelson and Tanya Stapp led to a new contract that stipulated new reporting practices for People Productions, and the new contract also stipulated that if large deviations from the budget occurred, People Productions should notify the Mateel Community Center. The new contract for Reggae on the River maintained a Mateel Community Center deposit account and a People Productions expense account. If People Productions had an expense, Ms. Matilla testified that the Mateel Community Center had to honor the transfer.
This case involves the lease agreement between Tom Dimmick and the Mateel Community Center. What does all of this information have to do with the lease agreement itself?
Mr. Bragg seemed to be trying to establish the intricacies of the new contract established for the 2006 event, and since Ms. Matilla was the bookkeeper, she would have the most knowledge about the different requirements of that contract when it came to the budget. Mr. Bragg questioned Ms. Matilla about the new requirements under the 2006 contract, and Ms. Matilla stated that the new 2006 contract asked for quarterly reports of assets and capital assets and things, reports that had never previously been required. Mr. Bragg went on to ask, did you provide all the reports stipulated in the new 2006 contract? Ms. Matilla said no. Mr. Bragg asked, what did you do to provide the information to Tanya Stapp? Ms. Matilla stated that throughout 2005 and 2006, Ms. Matilla transferred the information, all of her QuickBooks, which is her accounting software. She transferred her QuickBooks in April onto Tanya Stapp's computer, in July onto Tanya Stapp's computer, and in October, Ms. Stapp was not present, so Ms. Matilla printed the information, and in December, Ms. Matilla provided a disk of the accounting information instead of the reports that were stipulated in the 2006 contract. According to Susie Matilla, quote, Tanya Stapp was okay with the QuickBooks software. She did not object to the QuickBooks software, end quote.
questioning of Ms. Matilla wrapped up today, and Carol Bruno was scheduled to be on the stand next. Has she appeared yet, and has that questioning begun?
Yes, Carol Bruno came on the stand a little bit after 11 o'clock today.
After 11, and so what kind of questions has Bill Bragg been asking her?
The questions revolve around the 2006 contract negotiations and the fact that Hannah Nelson was Carol Bruno's personal attorney. Hannah Nelson also represented the Mateel Community Center, and that has been a topic of questioning for at least an hour. Mr. Bragg also has been questioning Ms. Bruno about whether or not there were plans to produce other events on the Dimmock Ranch after Reggae on the River, and Ms. Bruno has held that that was not being planned. In addition, the trial originally was just scheduled to go till Wednesday, and now it is obvious that the court needs to schedule additional days. So far, tentatively, they've scheduled the trial to be extended to February 20th, 21st, and 22nd for extra time. And earlier this afternoon, Mr. Knowles did ask the judge to please limit Mr. Bragg to a certain amount of days if necessary to complete the trial in a certain amount of days if the trial was limited in total to a specific amount of days.
So what's on schedule for tomorrow?
We haven't been told what's on schedule for tomorrow. We don't know if Carol Bruno's going to still be on the stand, and then it hasn't been announced as to who is the next witness being called.
That again was KMUD News Coordinator Terry Clementson. And that is all for the local news. Thank you for tuning in, and to Fred Barron for engineering. From our studio in Redway, this is Cynthia Elkins reporting for KMUD.
And tonight, from 7 to 8 o'clock, tune in to join Jimmy Derschlag, host of Global Stuff. Jimmy will start off the new year by once again turning to Iran and the looming military confrontation. His guest will be Reese Ehrlich, author of The Iran Agenda, the real story of U.S. policy and the Middle East crisis. The show will again be pre-recorded, so no call-ins, but lots of insights. Jimmy's show, Global Stuff, normally airs on Fridays. Tune in to this special broadcast of Global Stuff tonight from 7 to 8 p.m. only on the MUD. And stay tuned now for Free Speech Radio News coming right up.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, January 31st, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, Minnesota tribal members express concern about new border crossing ID requirements. A wheat shortage in Pakistan threatens the country's food supply. And the Israeli Supreme Court rules the country's imposed fuel shortages are not creating a human rights crisis in Gaza. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. New data shows that suicides among U.S. Army personnel are at their highest level since the Army began keeping records in the 1980s. Suicides jumped by as much as 20% in the past year. As many as 121 military personnel took their lives in 2007, although more than 30 of those deaths are under investigation to confirm if they were in fact suicides. Attempted suicides and self-inflicted injuries.